This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Indian Kashmir on Saturday held its first direct election since the government stripped its semi-autonomy last year. On high alert for attacks by separatist militants, dozens of police and paramilitaries with machine guns watched outside each voting station while army patrols toured the streets. The Himalayan region, which is also claimed by Pakistan, has been under heavy security since the ruling Hindu nationalist government imposed direct rule in August of 2019. But officials said nearly 52% of the 700,000 eligible voters cast ballots during the first of the 8 days of polling, braving the security, coronavirus fears, and snow-covered terrain to elect local council members. Results are expected on December 22nd. While the councils have only limited powers, several Kashmir political parties, including the influential PDP, formed an alliance to use the election to campaign for the restoration of the region's political autonomy. Kashmir has been divided between India and Pakistan since their bitter split at independence in 1947. Both claim the territory in full. And Ethiopian government forces began an offensive to capture the regional capital of the northern Tigray region on Saturday. This is according to diplomats in direct contact with residents, as well as the leader of local forces. The head of Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, told Reuters that Mekele was under heavy bombardment and that the Ethiopian military is using artillery in the assault. A spokeswoman for the prime minister's office said that the safety of Ethiopians in the region is a priority for the federal government. For more on this story, please visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Iran's supreme leader promised on Saturday to retaliate for the killing of the Islamic Republic's top nuclear scientist, raising the threat of a new confrontation with the West and Israel in the final weeks of Donald Trump's presidency. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei pledged to continue the work of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who Western and Israeli governments believe was the architect of a secret Iranian program to make weapons. Friday's killing, for which Iran's president blamed Israel, could complicate any efforts by President-elect Joe Biden to revive a detente with Tehran that was forged when he was in Barack Obama's administration. President Trump pulled Washington out of the 2015 International Nuclear Pact agreed between Tehran and major powers. The scientist was killed on Friday when he was ambushed near Tehran in his car, and his car was sprayed with bullets. He was rushed to the hospital where he died. Islamic State-linked extremists killed four people in a remote Christian community on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi, authorities said Saturday. One victim was beheaded and another burned to death. The attackers ambushed the village in central Sulawesi province Friday morning, killing several residents and torching half a dozen homes, including one used for regular prayers and services. This is according to police. No arrest had yet been made, and the motive for the attack was not immediately clear. But authorities pointed the finger at the Sulawesi-based East Indonesia Mujahideen, or MIT. It's one of dozens of radical groups across the Southeast Asian archipelago that have pledged allegiance to IS. Indonesia, which is the world's biggest Muslim majority nation, has long wrestled with Islamist militancy and terror attacks, while central Sulawesi has seen intermittent violence between Christians and Muslims for decades. If confirmed to be the work of MIT, Friday's killings would be its first significant attack since the organization's leader was killed 4 years ago by Indonesia's elite anti-terror squad. And dozens of rallies are planned Saturday against a new French law that would restrict sharing images of police, only days after the country was shaken by footage showing officers beating and racially abusing a black man. The case shocked France, with celebrities and politicians alike condemning the officers' actions, and has brought debate over President Emmanuel Macron's law to a boiling point. Macron on Friday called the incident an unacceptable attack and asked the government to come up with proposals to fight against discrimination. One of the most controversial elements of the new law is Article 24, which would criminalize the publication of images of on-duty police officers with the intent of harming them. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator is Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome to Washington, D.C., a capital city in transition. President Donald Trump has continued to claim there was fraud, there was cheating, there were abuses in the American election on November 3rd, but this past Monday agreed with the announcement by one of his government agencies that Joe Biden can begin the transition. Biden then named key officials for his administration, which is scheduled to begin with Inauguration Day, when he's to be sworn in as president, January 20th. Let's turn to our panel. President Trump did not concede that he lost the election, but he's not standing in the way of what's often called here a peaceful transition of power. Emily Tamkin?
Right. I interviewed Lawrence Douglas, who wrote the book Will He Go, about whether or not Trump would leave the White House a while ago. And he put forth a theory that I think we're seeing play out now, which is that Trump would not admit to defeat, but he would submit to defeat. Right. So in other words, he'll never say that he lost the election, but will eventually allow the wheels to turn such that Joe Biden is able to be inaugurated and go into the White House. We should say that the reason that he's submitting is that his legal challenges and reported pressure on lawmakers to flip electors. You know, in some ways, this is kind of the best case scenario given the players involved in this drama. You know, there are risks to a truncated transition. There are national security risks. Given that we're in a pandemic, the Biden team sort of needs as much information as they can have about the pandemic, about potential vaccine distribution as quickly as they can. So we're able to move ahead there now. The danger still that remains with the president submitting to but not admitting to defeat is that there are and will continue to be millions of people who don't believe that Joe Biden is the legitimate president because their choice is still telling them that he won and that this wasn't free and that this wasn't fair. And we'll have to see whether or not that does indeed do lasting damage to our democracy and our processes and our institutions. But this is not the worst thing that could happen. But that doubt that his supporters will carry forward, I think that will remain if the president continues to not admit that he lost.
Well, public opinion surveys indicated that most Republicans think there was cheating. So as you say, Emily, Republicans may feel that the outcome of the election, that the Joe Biden administration are not legitimate, and that could be a shadow over everything. Josh Glancy, when you write about this for your British newspaper, The Sunday Times, are you writing about this as kind of a reflection of Donald Trump's personality, that he can't accept that he lost something, or in fact a political play where Trump seriously wants to run again in the year 2024?
I think you can view the two as combined to some extent. I've never quite bought the idea that Trump will run again, although who knows? He's an unpredictable character. But the presidency takes a physical and emotional toll on anyone. And the idea of revving back up to do it again at 78, I find very unlikely, although he may enjoy the speculation. I do think in terms of the shadow cast over the presidency, we did see something similar happen to Donald Trump's presidency, which was widely considered illegitimate by many Democrats, including his opponent, Hillary Clinton, primarily because of Russian interference. And the two stories are not the same. There was significant Russian interference in the 2016 election. There does not seem to be any significant evidence of electoral fraud in 2020. But nonetheless, Trump's presidency was dogged by often overblown allegations of conspiracy and collusion that made his first 2 or 3 years, it massively impacted how effective he could be as president. We should hope that that doesn't happen to Biden. And I think the fact that there is so little foundation for Trump to go on means that really only the rump of the most diehard Trump supporters will view Biden as illegitimate by the time he occupies the White House and beyond.
Perhaps at the core of the feeling or the claim by Donald Trump, by other Republicans, that there was probably some kind of cheating and there were abuses, is that there were so many votes that were not cast in the old-fashioned way. On election day, people standing in line, going into a voting booth and then using some kind of machine to vote. But instead, they submitted their votes on paper, sometimes mailing them in, sometimes delivering them. And that, of course, was because of COVID-19, the coronavirus, where many Americans were afraid to gather together on election day. Now, the result was a record number of votes. We see a record 80 million votes for Joe Biden, the Democrat, while the Republican president got nearly 74 million votes, also a record, more than any loser in a U.S. election, a gap of more than 6 million votes. And in the electoral votes, where you add them up state by state, and to win, a candidate needs 270, we see 306 for Joe Biden. Now, Donald Trump did continue to tell his lawyers to challenge the count and to challenge what he considered to be fraud in states such as Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Georgia. But again and again, those claims were rejected by state and federal judges. It still brings us back to the question, Emily, whether you believe that Donald Trump is just trying to create a narrative that he was cheated and then he goes away forever, or whether there's a real chance he'll run again.
I don't know whether or not he'll run again, but I don't think that he's going to go away forever. I think that he just occupies such a large space in our political conscience, and maybe that will kind of decrease with time. But he has, not only does he have such a loyal following in terms of voters, but there are politicians now who are coming up who are modeling themselves after him in some ways. And so I think that the cliche is kind of like Trump is gone, but Trumpism remains. But I think Trump himself, though he will not be in the White House, will still continue to at least try to demand our attention.
Even during the couple of weeks when President Trump refused to concede that he lost the election and was blocking the process of letting the incoming administration have access to government funds and government information, Joe Biden, the winner, as far as we in the news media are concerned, it seems pretty clear Joe Biden was preparing his next administration. First, I'll note that he recently celebrated his 78th birthday. That was November 20th. He certainly is doing everything to appear active, and he's working on his new team. And he unveiled, for instance, his Secretary of State, assuming that the United States Senate confirms him. It's Antony, or Tony Blinken, who's been an advisor to Joe Biden for decades. During the Obama-Biden administration, Blinken worked in the White House. Then he was Deputy Secretary of State. So whether it's him or Jake Sullivan, who'll be Biden's national security advisor in the White House, he also worked in the Obama administration, as well as being close to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Does that add up to any strong clues that American foreign policy will definitely be different than it's been in the 4 years of Donald Trump, Josh?
Absolutely. It will be very different in style, certainly. Biden is making exactly the choices that he was predicted to make. Everyone was expecting Blinken to get either the state job or the NSA job, the National Security Advisor job. He will be America's chief diplomat. Jake Sullivan is another longtime Biden ally. Both of these people served in the Obama administration. So there's a lot of continuity from the Obama era. But, you know, Biden is himself a very experienced foreign policy politician and has his own view of how foreign policy should be conducted. And what we're going to see is a real attempt to restore America's traditional alliances, be they with Germany, be they with Japan, be they with the EU more generally. There's going to be a lot of focus on climate change. There will be some continuity with the Trump era. I think there will be a much tougher approach to China than there was during the Obama years. I think that's a permanent shift in American foreign policy. But it'll be done very differently. With Trump, it was always big headlines and bold gambits, and we're going into a trade war, and then we're going to have summits with North Korea and all this stuff that kind of had everyone in a tizzy. Whereas I think what we're going to see from the Biden team is a much more traditional, solid approach that exists well within the traditional guardrails of American foreign policy. They want to build America's alliances as a counterpoint to China and to renew some of these relationships, particularly with, say, a country like Germany that was very unhappy with America during the Trump era, and to sort of create a kind of firewall of democracies to hem China in. And that is exactly, the thing about this Biden team is, as the saying goes in a British advert, you get exactly what you see on the tin, which is these people, we know who they are. They are part of what's called the blob, the foreign policy blob in Washington, D.C. They've all written papers. They are well known. We're very acquainted with their thinking. And we're going to get exactly what we expect from them, really.
Read the label on the tin, as you say. Hey, Emily, what about John Kerry, who served as Secretary of State under President Obama? He's rejoining the government as a special envoy on climate issues. And climate, of course, is a big issue around the world. It was noted, of course, that one of the first things President Trump did was have the United States quit the Paris Climate Change Accords. Of course, the U.S. is heading back in, Emily.
Absolutely. And not only is John Kerry going to be the special envoy for climate change, but he will be participating in the National Security Council, which means that this will be the first time ever that there's been a person sitting at the council, going to those meetings, whose whole portfolio is climate change, which I think is significant and suggests that the Biden administration understands that they have to take the climate crisis seriously. What I will say is that foreign policy, I think, is one of the places to watch for tensions, maybe is the word, between the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the Biden administration. Yes, Kerry is there. Yes, he's going to be dealing with climate change. Yes, they have this person on the NSC. Yes, they're rejoining Paris. But the progressive wing of the party thinks that Kerry's too corporate in dealing with climate change. It's too, that there's too much focus on getting Republicans on board. So I think that we can expect to see some potential, if not clashes, then heated debates there.
Divisions among Democrats. We'll have more on the change of administration, which now seems certain on January 20th here in Washington, D.C., how the place of the U.S. in the world may change and other divisions in U.S. politics. More after this brief break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator, Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
We've been talking about how in the days before the major American holiday, Thanksgiving, which was this past Thursday, the president-elect, Joe Biden, revealed some of his choices for top national security jobs. Biden had the officials that he hopes will be with him. Many of them require U.S. Senate confirmation. On stage, also his future vice president, Senator Kamala Harris. This was in Biden's hometown, Wilmington, Delaware, this past Tuesday. Biden let each woman and man give a short speech. Everyone wore a mask because of the coronavirus, of course, and kept at least 6 feet or 2 meters away from each other. Taking off the mask at the podium in the middle only when it was his or her turn to speak. So, Josh Glancy, what did you think of the choreography of that piece of political theater?
It's in line with everything we've seen from Biden so far, which is a lot of very visible pandemic precaution and sign that they are serious, competent, grave people who understand the moment that America finds itself in, that the world finds itself in. And also this idea that we've touched on before, this is in many ways a restorationist administration. And these are quote unquote serious people with a lot of experience in American public life, where they want America to go in the future. And they are also Biden's family. I mean, Biden is a family man first and foremost. He talks about this a lot during the campaign and throughout his career and how much he cares about, you know, and the tragedies he's faced in his personal family, how close he is to his son and his children he lost. These advisors are also, he's framing them as family. So Blinken and Sullivan, who we've talked about, people who've been with him for over a decade, well over a decade. Kamala Harris, he mentioned he's mentioned in several speeches, your family now. How that pans out, we'll see. But he's trying to create a sense of a White House that is unified, that is collegiate, and that is serious.
Emily, when it comes to the Biden style, including his claim that he's out to unite the nation, is it going to work when it comes to all those Trump voters, especially the ones who feel that the Democrats somehow cheated?
I think that there are some Trump voters who are extremely devoted to Trump, who are never going to believe that Biden's the legitimate president, who are not interested in coming together. And in fact, who voted for Trump explicitly because Trump campaigned on us not coming together, right? He ran a very divisive campaign. However, I do think that there are some people where or for whom, if Biden offers good governance, if he gets us out of this pandemic, if the vaccine is distributed well, if they get economic relief, that they will, even if they don't vote for the Democrat in 2024, will come on board to the Biden project, right? Or even just the accept that this is America for the next 4 years. I think that the more practical issue that Biden faces is whether or not he will have enough Republican colleagues in the Senate, provided the Democrats do not manage to win both seats in the runoff election in Georgia in early January, that he will have enough Republican colleagues who are interested in governing with unity. Because if he does not manage to get enough Republicans on board, it's going to be very difficult to pass some of the legislation, not even like the bold, sweeping progressive legislation that some on the left want to see, but just to get anything done, right? We've seen before what can happen when there's divided government in Washington. It will make it very difficult for legislation to come through, and people will blame Biden for that.
Now, that's a great reminder that as a result of the November 3rd election, whereas the Democrats kept a majority in the House of Representatives, it is slimmed down a little bit, but they're still in the majority. You know, by the way, you know, this past Tuesday, when Joe Biden was introducing some of his future top officials, President Trump came into the White House briefing room really just for about 1 minute. He really just wanted to claim credit for the fact that the Dow Jones Industrials Average, right, the stock market, rose to 30,000 for the first time. He called it a sacred number. So he was claiming credit, but a lot of financial experts say that investors were buying stocks because they felt relieved that the election results are clearing up and they're fine with Joe Biden. And they like the fact that Biden would be choosing Janet Yellen, an economist, former head of the Federal Reserve Board, who served during the Obama years, to be Biden's Treasury Secretary. Wall Street feels safe with her. Now, Josh, what about the reality, though, that investors and, frankly, rich people get richer as stocks go up, even while millions of Americans have lost their jobs because of COVID-19? The irony is just one of these glaring facts about American capitalism.
Yes, I mean, it's worth recalling that most Americans, particularly older ones, have some investment with their 401k in the stock market. But the inequality we've seen over the pandemic has been very stark. People like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos have made tens and tens of billions of dollars, even while unemployment has hit 15% in America. And it was curious to me how little discussion there was of this rather salient fact during the election campaign. I do think there is an enormous problem with inequality in this country, but if you're on Wall Street, I guess you're not that bothered about that, and you're looking at the stability of having a very familiar character like Janet Yellen running the Treasury. You're looking at a Biden administration probably without the Senate, although we don't know, and therefore unable to do any sweeping economic change. And you're thinking this could be a good, stable few years to make some money. And that, yeah, may well only enlarge some of the fissures of inequality that exists within American society.
Emily, another cause of optimism among many Americans is vaccines, right? Vaccines against COVID-19 have been developed by several corporations, also work at Oxford University in Great Britain. What do you think about that? I mean, Americans seem to be ready to roll up their sleeves and get the jabs, the injections, some of them maybe just 1 month from now. That seems like quite a breakthrough.
The first thing that I want to say is that, yes, it is a breakthrough. And it's very, not even as a journalist, just as a person living through this, it's comforting to know that there's a light at the end of this long and dark tunnel. However, as a journalist, I will remind that the fact that the vaccine exists will not actually of itself help people, right? It's the vaccination that will help people, which means that we need to have the vaccine distributed quickly and widely and safely. And we also need to have enough people believe that the vaccines are safe, that they should take them, that they should use them. And what I would also just add is that, yes, the vaccine is coming, but it's not here yet. And it will not be here in time, say, for the holiday season. And so people continue to take the precautions that they've been taking for the duration of this pandemic and not drop their guards just because there is a vaccine coming.
Health officials in this country were very concerned about the Thanksgiving holiday as Americans planned on getting together. Some families said, no, we'll do it on a Zoom call. Maybe we'll hang out in the backyard if it's not too rainy or too cold. But quite a few families were driving or even flying. Airports were busy again. Thanksgiving is that much of a tradition of folks getting together. So there's some concern in a few weeks we might see the result of that. Josh Glancy, reason to worry?
Yes, definitely. As Emily says, we have an end in sight, we think, to this pandemic. As our my Prime Minister Boris Johnson says, the hooves of the cavalry are be heard over the hill, but they're not here yet. And so in many ways, this is the final push. And talking to a lot of relatives in the UK, they're saying that the UK is going to open up for 5 days over Christmas. but that will mean that they may have to close down the whole of January. Maybe that's a trade-off some people want to make after a very long, difficult year to gather with their families at Christmas. But certainly, as far as I'm concerned, I'm thinking about my first mojito in July on at a proper party with people and thinking, I'm pretty happy to hunker down for this winter to get there. And that's probably the best approach. But, you know, people are gathering. There are ways to gather. If you get tested and you quarantine, then there are reasonably safe ways to gather. The worry is that some people are just fed up with the whole thing. They have real COVID fatigue and aren't bothering with many precautions at all at this point. And that will just cause more pain and more deaths between now and mass vaccination, which will hopefully come by the middle of next year.
Not just here in the United States, but all around the world, there is what some call COVID fatigue. Not everyone has the discipline to wear the mask, to keep their distance a year, perhaps more in some places. Yeah, it's hard. I was thinking about this when it comes to foreign affairs and America's place in the world. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who's to be nominated by Joe Biden as the ambassador to the United Nations. She's a veteran diplomat. Everyone says she, frankly, was chased out of the State Department by President Trump's people nearly 4 years ago. She said, America is back. Multilateralism is back. Diplomacy is back. And I think we're seeing reactions, for instance, in the Middle East, right? Reports came out from Israel that that country's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last weekend made a clandestine trip to Saudi Arabia for talks with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, probably sharing their concerns that Biden won't be so tough on Iran as Trump has been. Josh, add that to the Trump plan to pull out a lot of U.S. troops from Iraq and Afghanistan before he leaves office in January. There's a shakeup in that part of the world.
There certainly is. The Middle East is probably the area where Trump foreign policy has had some of its most notable impact. They have massively changed America's approach to Iran. They pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. They've imposed hugely tough sanctions on Iran, and they've created this anti-Iran alliance that sort of already existed, but it's really come out into the open between Israel and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and others. And there are concerns that Biden administration will seek to recreate some kind of nuclear agreement with Iran. Jake Sullivan, who we've discussed, the new national security advisor, was very involved in the last nuclear agreement with Iran. And so definitely the likes of Bibi Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman will be anxious about this. Again, I don't think we're going to see direct Obama 2.0. I don't think we're going to see another JCPOA, which was the name of the agreement. But we probably will see a bit of a realignment. And that probably is something that MBS and Bibi want to get their heads together about and make sure that they can kind of sustain some of the gains they've made over the last 4 years.
Emily, bring it on home for us, right? When the new Biden administration will claim that America is back and multilateralism is back, what impact do you think that'll have? And by the way, do American voters really care, right? They didn't vote based on foreign policy.
Right. American voters did not vote based on foreign policy. Understandably, right? If there's a pandemic and there's job losses every week and et cetera, I think, and I say this as a person who follows foreign affairs closely and writes on it and reports on it, but like it's a luxury to be able to do that. Having said that, I think that proof will be in the pudding if America's back and multilateralism is back, right? You can't just say it. That is something that you demonstrate with your policy and your action. So we will see. I think that the appointment that you were speaking of at the UN, I think that will be very heartening for career diplomats in the State Department. I do think that the Biden administration will try to re-engage in multilateral fora. I would also say that in terms of the American example of democracy and human rights, that that is in part contingent on what we do at home. And that if the Biden administration sees its domestic policy as an extension of its foreign policy and vice versa, you know, then America will be back. And actually, not even back, but at a will have earned a place that it actually previously had not.
That's all the time we have for Issues in the News. Thanks to our panelists, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, and Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the British newspaper, The Sunday Times. This program is produced here in Washington by the Voice of America. I'm Dan Revive.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, guest host of this edition of PC USA. The coronavirus pandemic has touched the lives of people all around the world and in so many different ways. For millions of young women and girls, the United Nations Sexual and Reproductive Health Agency, UNFPA, says the pandemic is jeopardizing their future by reversing progress on ending child marriage and female genital mutilation, also known as female circumcision. A recently released report by UNFPA says some 33,000 girls are forced into early marriage every day, usually to much older men. The report added an estimated 4.1 million young women and girls are at risk of FGM this year, and 2 million more girls could undergo FGM in the next decade, beyond what would have been expected, as COVID-19 disrupts global efforts to end the practice. A senior researcher with Human Rights Watch in Kenya, Agnes Adiambo, says the pandemic has resulted in a disturbing increase of violence against women, which also includes domestic violence, sexual abuse, trafficking, and an increase in FGM. A CARE report indicates that women, girls, and other vulnerable populations are at increased risk of violence during the pandemic, which may surge under quarantine measures or movement restrictions. For example, girls and women's rights advocates are concerned that increased poverty during the current pandemic is leading to an increase in FGM and also is allowing it to continue unchecked as children remain out of school and people are mostly confined to their homes. In Kenya, for example, the practice was outlawed in 2011. Police and community leaders often collaborate with activists to coordinate raids of planned cuttings. Kenyan activist Gladys Kosegi says the pandemic is making it worse. She also believes that penalties are less likely to be enforced during the coronavirus outbreak as authorities are wary of crowding prisons. In another example, the nonprofit AHA Foundation announced that here in the U.S., amidst the COVID-19 pandemic, legislators in Kentucky passed a comprehensive ban against FGM that provides support to survivors, educates professionals and communities, and criminalizes the practice. A recently released UNICEF report in June of this year found that in Malawi, because of cases brought to court, child marriages were annulled and girls had the opportunity to return to school. Fewer adolescents experienced FGM compared with older generations. In Ethiopia, for example, 47% of girls aged 15 to 19 have undergone FGM compared with 75% of women aged 35 to 49 years. Joining me today to discuss how efforts to outlaw FGM continue despite increases in the practice during the coronavirus pandemic is Dr. Justine Carlson, Acting Regional Director for the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, in East and Southern Africa. Also on the panel is my colleague, VOA journalist Ayan Buer. I welcome you both to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Dr. Carlson, during this pandemic, how is failing to pay particular attention to the specific needs of women and girls in times of crisis undermining their basic rights?
So what we found in Eastern Southern Africa when the first wave of the pandemic came back in February, March, was that as lockdowns were put in place, and they were very strict lockdowns at the beginning, not enough thought was given to how we could ensure that women could still access critical services for their sexual and reproductive health, critical information, or if we're talking about issues such as gender-based violence, safe spaces where women and girls can go to escape their abusers. And so a lot of work that we did in those early stages was really working with governments and other partners to look at how we could continue to deliver services safely, even in the time of COVID. So really looking at both the safety of the women and girls that need services and also looking at the safety of the health workers. So that required us to provide a lot of new clinical or technical information to the health workers so they knew how to reorganize their services. It required us to procure large amounts of PPE and get those out to maternal health facilities, safe spaces, which weren't necessarily being prioritized at that time because inevitably a lot of PPE, a lot of the focus on investment was in setting up COVID-19 wards. I think at the same time, it was about working closely with our grassroots partners, such as our peer educators and other community-based organizations, to go out and visit women and girls in their homes and tell them where they can get services, where they can get information, so that the expression of their sexual and reproductive health and rights could continue and would not be denied during the time of COVID-19.
And just looking at the practice of female genital mutilation or female circumcision, I just want to look at the history and the culture behind this particular procedure. And with this, Ayanna, I want to go to you. I know you want to have some comments on this and perhaps a question to Dr. Coulson.
Yeah, I would absolutely love to hear Dr. Coulson's thoughts on this because, you know, just during the course of my reporting, I've noticed a pattern. And I've noticed that when it comes to female genital mutilation, it is really something that is encouraged by older women and pressured upon younger women. But in a lot of countries, you see that it is the women who are pressuring young girls or, you know, maybe even forcing them to have this surgery performed on them. And Dr. Coulson, I was wondering if you had thoughts on that. Is this a cultural issue or is it societal? What exactly is driving female genital mutilation in communities around the world?
So one of the fundamental reasons why you will see older women in a community pushing for female genital mutilation is because of the close link between FGM and preparedness for marriage. And so what you will also see is in terms of when there's a lot of economic pressures on a household, we therefore see girls at increasing risk of earlier marriage. So child marriage becomes earlier and earlier. And at the same time, therefore, there is greater and greater pressure to put your girl through the FGM practice in order that you can then get her married off. So just as those older women may be those that are pushing young girls to go forward for the FGM practice, at the same time, we believe very strongly that working with both the older women who are the circumcisers in the community, the older women who are grandmothers and mothers and maybe have seen this practice continuing over the generations, can also be critical players in terms of helping us to work with communities to abandon FGM. So one particular group of older women we work with are traditional leaders, so female chiefs. We have a particular chief, for example, that we work in Malawi, and she's actually known as the Terminator. And that's because she has really taken it upon herself, you know, to work with her community to abandon child marriage. And then we have other traditional female leaders that we work with who similarly work in communities with high levels of FGM, and they're critical players in going and talking to key stakeholders, heads of household, explaining why FGM is not the only way to express your culture. What we always say is, you know, we want to respect culture, but that when it infringes on the human rights of women and girls, that's not the right way to express culture. We also do a lot of work with communities looking at alternative rites of passage. So recognizing that many communities need that sort of cultural moment when we mark that transition from childhood to womanhood, but finding alternative ways that communities can come together and celebrate that with the young girls without having to resort to harmful practices.
Dr. Coulson, what are some of the physical and psychological consequences women and girls experience going through this procedure?
So we know, I mean, what we very often say is that it's a harm today that cascades through a girl's life. So we know that, you know, just the immediate pain, risk of infection at the time when the circumcision is done, there can be, you know, long-term damage, scarring, which in turn, when the young woman is then ready to start a family, we can see complications in childbirth. There can be psychological impacts as well. It's very much one moment of harm that continues to pass through her life.
And how has the COVID pandemic affected some of your efforts in working with these women who are trying to ban it or look for alternative ways to celebrate the rites of passage?
We've been working very closely with partner governments. And in fact, before I came to this interview today, I was sitting in an interministerial meeting between ministers in Uganda and ministers in Kenya. And they had come together to look at the phenomenon of cross-border FGM, where girls in Uganda are sometimes brought across the border into Kenya for FGM, and how the two governments can work more closely together to address this issue. But what we were also discussing in that meeting is how interventions during COVID-19, where we have integrated FGM prevention into broader COVID-19 responses, have actually been the most effective way to continue to prevent FGM happening. So, for example, in Uganda, what we saw was FGM sits within the COVID National Response Plan. It is a key element of the COVID-19 response. And then when you get down to district level, we also have FGM reflected in their COVID-19 health action plans. And what that meant was that health workers were trained to continue to screen for FGM. They were trained on where the safe spaces were going to be for girls that were escaping from FGM. And in that way, we've actually been able to continue to keep prevention measures in place despite the challenges of COVID-19.
We've seen how COVID-19 has impacted so many aspects of our lives around the world. We've seen how COVID has impacted medical care for women around the world, you know, as women have become less likely to go into a hospital for fear of catching COVID-19 there. So as a consequence, things like breast cancer screenings have gone down, which is worrisome. And also sexual and reproductive services have scaled back. Gender-based violence hotlines have seen a rise in the calls that they receive. And I think that the disruption in schooling might be the biggest consequence for young girls and women in terms of FGM. What is school at the end of the day? School is not only a place where young girls can learn, but it can be a place where young girls are given help. It could also give a chance for teachers to notice and then also report abuse, whatever type of abuse the young girl might be undergoing. And so, Dr. Colson, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, about the disruption of schooling around the world and how that particularly might impact rates of female genital mutilation.
So when we first went into COVID, and I think what we do need to point out for your listeners, so I mean, I work within Eastern Southern Africa, and actually the way that COVID-19 has played out, say in comparison to Europe and the US, is that we've really come to the end of the first phase, and many societies have reopened, schools have reopened, and so there is some return to normality, even if mask use and other COVID prevention measures are still in place. But when we first went down into lockdown, one of our key concerns was with our young people across the region, and particularly adolescent girls and young women, both in terms of their mental health, then also being isolated in households where they might not be safe, they may be at risk of gender-based violence, linked to FGM, recognizing that when the household comes under greater economic pressure, pushing a girl into FGM can be a form of sort of negative coping behavior for the family. And so we actually held a series of webinars to really understand how girls were coping with this and how we could provide better support. And it was very, very clear that what we needed to do is to keep our peer educators out in the community. So whilst we were to some extent restricted from being able to go out into communities in the way that we would have done in the past, we supported our peer educators with up-to-date COVID-19 information, with additional information on how to screen for girls at risk, how to make contact. And then we actually started backing that up with mobile services going into communities. It was definitely very hard for those partners that we work with who deliver certain elements of their programs through schools when schools closed, because schooling does have a protective element for girls in a whole range of ways. And we see the statistics on that. It sets them up for, you know, a greater economic benefit later in life. We know that literacy has a huge protective factor against a number of negative health outcomes. We know it protects them from child marriage. And so this was an initial concern. But, you know, as I say, I think the focus then was trying to move into the community and do more door to door when we couldn't get that information into the school. And the other issue was to really ensure that we kept safe spaces going. So even in the interministerial meeting that I was at today, we were talking about an example in Kenya where there were a number of girls that were rescued from an FGM right. And they were rescued and then put into a safe house to protect them. But then there is then actually something called a family-based care model, where rather than keeping those girls in an institution, which really wasn't the best thing to do at the time of COVID either, the family-based care model actually puts them back with extended family members who are committed to protecting them from FGM. And we know that also has a better mental health outcome for them. It tends to allow them to stay close to their community, their friends and their schools. And so that was one of the ways in which we ensured there was a protective factor.
Okay, and on that note, we'll take a short break. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Dr. Justine Carlson, Acting Regional Director for the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, in East and Southern Africa. Also on the panel is VOA journalist Ian Bior. I'm Kim Lewis. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener in Nigeria, Gloria Alabadin. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Now back to our program with our guest, Dr. Justine Carlson, Acting Regional Director for the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, in East and Southern Africa, and my colleague, VOA journalist, Ian Bior. Well, female circumcision is still a global practice, as we've been talking about, though some countries have outlawed it and banned it, as I mentioned in the introduction. So how do you get public policy efforts and programs for the elimination of this practice continuing to be implemented during a pandemic?
It's true that we have all of the countries in East Africa that I work with have outlawed FGM and actually taken a number of measures to make sure that perpetrators who are practicing FGM are actually brought to justice under those laws. There was obviously a risk during the time of COVID-19 because of lockdown that communities became quite shut off with less movement between communities and therefore I think less flow of intelligence in terms of what was happening. UNFPA and UNICEF have had a joint program. It's the largest joint program in the world on FGM and it's been running for a number of years. So through the development of that program and working with communities over time, we have a series of anti-FGM champions based at the heart of communities in our network who we could continue to work with to get intelligence around girls that were at risk, to get intelligence around any form of prevention intervention that was being disrupted, and then really to continue to support them in their efforts to prevent FGM happening in the community.
And also, I think that any public policy efforts need to involve men. I mean, you talk about champions who fight against FGM. I think it's important that those champions are also men because, you know, FGM is done on women, but it's done for men. It's an attempt to control a woman's sex life with the thought that she will be more loyal to her husband, making her presumably more desirable. So I think that we have to involve men in the conversation because they do have a lot of influence. And I think that educating them on the dangers of FGM and encouraging them to become advocates against the practice could go a long way.
I would completely agree. And I, you know, one of the things we're really looking at now is because we do work with men in communities, but, you know, also looking at how can we start to work with boys at an earlier age, looking at the comprehensive sexuality education curricula in schools, sometimes known as life skills in certain countries. But how can we introduce in there, I think, not just teaching around why FGM is wrong, but I think also just looking at rights around bodily autonomy and integrity, upholding gender equality, how boys can move into a gender equal relationship with their girlfriends and wives in the future. And so that, you know, as we're looking at how we're developing the joint program interventions here in East and Southern Africa, that's becoming more and more of an important point of intervention for us.
It's a really good point. Thanks for bringing that up, Ian. So what can a young woman or girl do to really empower herself to speak out, especially if she's in a country where women's voices go unnoticed?
So what we've noticed, I think, particularly over the last 4 to 5 years, we have an incredible generation of young people in Africa at the moment. And, you know, you will hear us talking about the youth bulge, because we have a huge youth population, but a youth population that's connected and educated in a way that it's never been before. And so in many ways, we've seen young girls themselves coming to the fore. I mean, without any intervention from UNFPA or the government or maybe a not-for-profit partner, but girls who really have claimed their agency, not only to step up for themselves, but also then to look at ways to achieve social change by engaging with others in their community. And what we do see is that when we look at communities that formally abandon FGM, yes, it's around engaging with those older community members, both men and women, but it's very often those girls that are brave and strong enough to stand up for the first time and say, I don't want to be circumcised. This is not right for me. It's not necessary, nor is it necessary for the girls, my peers in my community. And so some of the work that UNFPA does is focusing much more on rights and empowerment. So when we look at comprehensive sexuality education, other forms of information around health and well-being, we always try and include in there elements of empowerment or leadership skills to really help those girls that have that potential to be leaders against FGM in their communities and other harmful practices to really feel that they are supported enough to stand up and speak out.
You mentioned that the practice has been outlawed there in East Africa, in these countries. What role does law enforcement play in making sure that those that are committing a crime, that they are punished for it?
So one of the challenges we see is that obviously, whilst you may see national laws in place, and you may even see those being understood and enforced at district level or provincial level, inevitably, when you get down to smaller communities and your local law enforcement officer is also your neighbor or maybe your uncle or a member of extended family, that dynamic can become more challenging. And this was actually something that we were discussing today at the interministerial meeting. And a minister for Kenya was extremely clear that one of the things that government must play a role in, particularly ministers, is making it very clear to traditional leaders, law enforcement, health workers, that at community level, those laws will be enforced. So first of all, making those laws very clear so that they are fully understood, then making clear that they will be enforced, and then obviously having a number of cases that are successfully brought to court that are used as demonstration cases. At the same time, alongside that law enforcement piece, we know that that isn't enough. And so we really have to keep focusing on the sort of socio-cultural norm change, you know, that softer piece where we really need to work with communities and stakeholders over time so they really come to a point where they no longer value FGM and they value a much more empowered approach to bringing their girls into womanhood.
You know what, I could not agree with that more. And I think of a place like South Sudan where child marriage is against the law, and yet child marriage still happens in a lot of places in South Sudan because it is cultural. And I was speaking to a young woman a couple of years ago she was 16 years old, and her parents were forcing her to get married to a man who was more than twice her age. And one of the things that I asked her was, well, why don't you go to the police? You know, child marriage, this is what they're doing is illegal. And she just basically said, you know what, because the police will be on my parents' side. And so when we talk about enforcement, I think that that's really critical, because the victims have to know that if they do report this, if they do go into a hospital or a police station to report, you know, that someone is trying to force them to undergo female circumcision, they need to know that the authorities will be on their side. And I do think that there are issues with that trust between victims and law enforcement.
And I think going back to my earlier comment, this is why traditional leaders who sometimes have greater influence and power over communities than necessarily law enforcement when we get down to grassroots level, are such critical players in determining whether or not FGM is abandoned within a community. And, you know, and this is why we continue to invest so much time in working with traditional leaders and really trying to help them to become champions against FGM as a practice.
I wanted to add, in a unified statement put out in June of this year, the UNFPA, UNICEF, and UN Women said you remain strongly committed to working with governments and all stakeholders to build societies where women and girls are free of violence and all forms of discrimination by 2030. How close are you to this goal?
We stay completely committed to our goal, which is zero gender-based violence, FGM, child marriage, and other harmful practices by 2030. You know, unfortunately, I think when we look at COVID-19, and you mentioned this in your opening comments, Kim, and the fact that when we look at some of the disruptions we see around the world, we're actually estimating that we could see an additional 2 million additional FGM cases by 2030, despite all of our efforts jointly across the UN, with governments and other partners to prevent FGM moving forward. So we are still a long way from that goal. However, what I would say is we have seen certain communities and countries where we have seen accelerated progress towards abandonment. So when you look at hotspots of FGM around the world, what you will see is that both within an individual country, particularly in East Africa, you will have certain hotspots of FGM. It's not a nationally prevalent practice. And so that in itself has been a step forward towards getting to zero. And what it means now is that we're at a point where we can make much more targeted, focused investments in getting us to that critical zero number. So I remain hopeful for the countries in my region that through the strong partnerships that we've established, both with government and communities and others, that we can get to zero by 2030 for FGM.
Well, I would like to ask this one question. Dr. Coulson, you talked about this a little bit earlier in the show, in getting governments to prioritize access to services and the justice system for women and girls. How challenging is that really?
I think that's very contextual. I think it's more challenging in other some places than others. But, you know, for example, last year we had the Nairobi Summit, which was celebrating 25 years since the International Conference on Population Development, which was a key event when reproductive rights were recognized by governments all over the world. And at that summit, a number of presidents and other high-level officials from countries came and made a number of very concrete commitments to accelerate progress towards the zeros by 2030. And in many ways, what we're doing now, 1 year on, is working with governments to remind them of those commitments and to really ensure, I think, particularly as we move into 2021, where we know there are going to be huge economic pressures on countries as we recover from COVID-19, that those commitments still stand, that investments continue to be made, and that presidents and ministers continue to be vocal champions to end FGM and other harmful practices.
And on that note, we'll end the show. That is all the time we have. I would like to thank my guest, Dr. Justine Coulson, Acting Regional Director for the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, in East and Southern Africa. And of course, thanks to my colleague, VOA journalist, Diane Buhr. Thank you both so much for a very insightful program and for sharing your insights on the culture behind FGM and the importance of banning and outlawing this practice that has been deemed as violence and abuse against women and girls. Thank you both. This was really good. Thanks for your questions, Ayan.
Of course, yeah. Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for focusing on the topic. Thank you so much.
Press Conference USA was produced in Washington. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.